This is the panel Apocalypse How on Political Economy of Energy, Catastrophism, and Reigniting the Radical Imagination. My name is Arun Gupta. We're going to go in the order that we're sitting. To the right of me is Eddie Yuen, who is one of the co-authors of this terrific book on catastrophism, which I highly, highly recommend, because the idea for this panel is that the idea catastrophism, in other words, the end of the world ideas, has acquired a dominant strain on the left within the environmental movements, and we think that there are many problems with this, very deep-seated problems that are, in fact, are often dangerous. So I'm just going to give some introductory remarks. Eddie is going to deal with more the political implications, and then we have the brilliant Doug Henwood, economist. He publishes a Left Business Observer. He's a contributing editor to The Nation, and he'll deal with more the political economy issues. And then Frances, when she gets here, she is going to deal with social movement history. And we're planning to leave plenty of time for discussion. We all know what we think. You know, we want to hear what everyone else has to think too, and engage in a useful dialogue. So I'm just going to start out with a little story, a little vignette. In the last 3 years, I've done 7 cross-country road trips across the United States with my partner, Michelle Fawcett. We've been reporting on the Occupy movement, labor, environmental issues, just all sorts of issues all over the country. And on one of our trips, it took us through Youngstown, Ohio, which used to be a center of the steel industry. The Mahoning Valley was basically littered with steel plants, almost 30 of them. It was known as Little Steel, a major producer of steel products, especially for the auto industry. And it's been absolutely devastated. 70% population loss, almost half the buildings in the city have been abandoned. But there is a little life that's coming back in terms of the energy industry. Fracking is very active in the Marcellus Shale in the region, and local anti-fracking activists took us to see a well pad, that there was a spot from a road where we could get a really good vantage point of it. Now, from close up, a fracking well looks like a miniature factory. The heart is the drill head and tower into which the steel piping, cement casing, and fracking fluid goes. There are large tanks of propant nearby that feed into a hopper where it's mixed with a foaming fluid. After millions of liters of chemical slurry are shot through the pipe to fracture the shale, it's pumped back up with natural gas and separated. The gas is often compressed on site to make it easier to transport, while the used chemical fluid is stored until it'll be treated. The entire operation is surrounded by tanks, shipping containers, pyramids of steel piping that stretch for miles when connected, dozens of trucks, and lots of heavy-duty construction and excavation equipment. After seeing this fracking pad near Youngstown, I had done this right after I had come from spying on a steel plant, a French-owned steel plant nearby. We weren't allowed access, so we had to go down a service road and ended up being chased by security guards. And now this plant, the V&M plant, it stretches for hundreds and hundreds of yards. It manufactures thousands of tons of steel piping for use in drilling shale formations. And the facility is part of a larger complex of oil equipment manufacturing that employs more than 1,000 workers in total. The non-union factory positions at this plant are some of the best blue-collar jobs in the area, paying up to $25 an hour. At the fracking well site, it was evident how many jobs were involved there as well. One pad requires anywhere from 200 to 2,000 tanker truckloads of chemicals. The building, operation, and maintenance of the well requires dozens of workers. The piping, cement, chemicals, and equipment are mostly manufactured in the United States. All the wastewater and natural gas need to be trucked out as well. The heavy equipment tears up roadways, the fracking waste is treated at nearby wastewater plants, and regular accidents and spills need to be cleaned up. While the fracking work crews usually come from out of state and engage in antisocial behavior, ranging from sexual assaults to bar fights to drunk driving. They also pump a lot of money into depressed economies. I've driven across Oklahoma a few times in recent years, and it's difficult to get a motel room along the interstate because all the rooms are occupied by workers employed in the oil and gas industry, which is experiencing a fracking-led boom. The same is true in North Dakota. The per capita income has gone from one of the lowest in the United States to one of the highest as a result of the fracking oil boom there, even as the social fabric is being ripped apart by the influx of outside single men with too much money and aggression. On the same road trip through Ohio and then Oklahoma, Michelle and I were headed for Los Angeles. After passing through Las Vegas and going southwest through the Spring Mountain Range, we crossed into California and spied a giant white metal tower stretching into the sky. In succession were two more gleaming towers, each more than 450 feet tall. Thousands of mirrors in concentric circles tilted towards the towers. As we raced through the sun-saturated landscape, I took to Google to figure out what we were looking at. We were next to Ivanpah Solar, the biggest solar thermal facility in the world, capable of generating almost 400 megawatts at peak power, enough to supply 144,000 homes in California with electricity. The facility was constructed by Bechtel, and it touted the 2,700 employees needed to manufacture all the towers, mirrors, and power-generating equipment. Hidden away in their publicity materials was the fact that once Ivanpah was up and running, the operations and maintenance required all of 90 employees. 90, that's it. That's probably what a single fracking well requires for its operation. It immediately dawned on me that what the reason why the oil and gas industry is so hard to displace, despite the many advantages of low carbon power sources like wind and solar, is because there's a political economy of destruction. The fact that the hydrocarbon industry is ripping up, pulverizing, and fouling the earth is not incidental. It is the business model, as Naomi Klein observes. On the other side, while renewable energies are far from neutral, there's no such thing as a wind explosion or a solar spill. The contrast between renewables and hydrocarbons is an issue of social organization, even more than one of ecology. Now, there's a solution to the ecological crisis that is wonderfully simple in theory, but maddeningly difficult in practice: social control of the production, distribution, and consumption of resources. We can't hide from the fact that a low-carbon economy will mean less jobs. Rather, this fact needs to be embraced, and I'm firmly of the opinion that socialism is the only way out of this mess, and solutions on the level of the modern state are necessary. Now, I raise this in relation to the topic we're going to discuss today, catastrophism, because there are no silver bullets. There are no technological fixes to the 8 or 9 different intertwined ecological crises that includes climate change. We can't stampede people into the dramatic social transformation we need by trying to frighten them that human civilization is about to collapse. The reality is, as dire as the consequences will be, humans will adapt. The longer we wait and delay, the more hideous any adaptation will be, outstripping the horrors like the Black Death, late Victorian Holocaust, and even the Nazi Holocaust. More important, climate catastrophe is not something in the future. It's already arrived, and its impact is happening across an uneven social geography. For the vast majority of Americans, the climate crisis is relatively abstract, as terrible as Katrina, Sandy, and the Western droughts and wildfires have been. The apocalypse here, though, is here, though, in cultural terms. Hollywood is saturated with movies about the end of humanity, the world, and the universe. Global warming directly shows up in many movies like Day After Tomorrow, AI, Snowpiercer, Elysium, and Cloud Atlas. The problem is that we have to face is a climate crisis can become normalized, just like the war on terror has become normalized, because the timescale of the crisis will play out not over years, but decades and even centuries. Capitalists will look to profit by offering techno fixes like geoengineering. Demagogues are happy to use fear-mongering to whip up aggression against demonized groups, especially climate refugees in the future. The state will harness both forces to accumulate more power and force, and as a site to impose unequal distribution to vital resources and to impose the burdens of the ecological crisis on those who can least afford it and had the least to do with it. Transitioning to a low-carbon economy, while necessary, is going to do little to slow down the problems of habitat loss, mass species extinction, the nitrogen cycle crisis, coral reef die-offs, and the problem of invasive species. Now, the apocalyptic mindset is in many ways an admission of political defeat. It tries to panic the public to respond to a ticking time bomb. Powerful social movements are built through careful and thorough consideration of what tactics, strategies, and ideas can best combine to help construct durable and dynamic movements. These strategies, tactics, and ideas also have to be bold and not compromising in our vision for a better, more just society or defense of the earth and humanity. Nor should it play safe according to what unaccountable funders and institutions desire. Most important, while we can't gloss over the threats facing humanity or the planet, the path we're on requires building multi-generational movements that grow in power, vision, and capability over time. Capitalism was not built in a day, neither will it be dismantled overnight or through an ecological shock, no matter how extreme.
Okay, thanks, Arun. Well, a lot of what I have to say is really, in terms of conclusions, I feel is being manifested at the Monday action and many of the speakers and events going on here, the climate conversions. In other words, the climate movement that we need is already here. It just needs to be grown and nurtured. Climate justice, so-called, is a response to, as Arun said, the ubiquity of apocalyptic discourse in the culture at large and the reality of a genuinely apocalyptic crisis, if you might say so, around climate. And as Arun mentions, many of the other interrelated environmental crises. So I think what I want to focus on is to consider the different kinds of politics that can emerge from in response to this crisis, right? I mean, we have the denialists in the U.S. and very few other places who say there is no climate crisis. But in general, this position, I think, is going to go into decline. I think what we're going to see more and more is every nation state, every elite in the world, every social movement in the world, every individual and community in the world is going to have to deal with this crisis. How does it manifest itself? And it's sometimes, I used to feel this a little bit myself, if only people would just realize what's going on, if only we could just rattle their cages and say, wake up, this is happening, that it would follow that there'd be a kind of progressive, enlightened, compassionate, humanitarian, nuanced politics that takes into account the global injustices of the world that already exist. But sad to say, this kind of politics may not naturally emerge from knowledge of the crisis. And in fact, probably won't, because there are many other forces that are going to proffer and offer other kinds of solutions. So again, to reiterate a crucial point, this crisis is not in the future somewhere far off. It's actually already here. It's not evenly distributed, to paraphrase William Gibson, right? And it may take different forms in different parts of the world. It may take the form of war, disease, health crises in general. It may not always manifest itself as a climate crisis. And so we can expect from those nation states and elites in general, I mean, not to be across the board, there's going to be a lot of differences amongst various global and economic and political elites, but we can sort of see a kind of constellation of solutions. I will mention sort of three large solutions that are on offer that basically reinforce the current status quo with regards to inequality and that really don't deal with, I think, one of the root causes of the problem, which is the political economic system that we live in. Naomi Klein is naming capitalism. This is becoming more and more of a discourse which I think should be promoted to really seriously discuss, you know, what are the root causes. It's not simply compound growth. It's also the commodity form. It's also a certain notion around the relation between humans and nature. So the first one that we're going to see a lot of, and we're already seeing it, is technical solutions. Technical solutions in the form of, say, the extreme form of geoengineering, right? And that, I think there's probably panels on this here at this convergence. I won't have to say too much about it, except that it is, at the very least, controversial. There is going to be a lot of resistance to these kinds of solutions. But solutions in general that regard, that see even the continuing burning of carbon into the atmosphere as something which can be solvable through new investments and new technologies, right? So in other words, the spider that swallowed the fly is maybe a good example for some of this, that you're going to double down on certain kinds of technical solutions to problems that were created in part by not considering what was going to go on with this giant chemistry experiment of the last 200 years of releasing massive amounts of fossilized creatures into the atmosphere. These kinds of solutions, again, we're going to, I think, see more of them, and they'll be presented to us as inevitable. They may be, in fact, initiated by states which don't have formal democracy, and some of you may include this one. So this is one branch of solutions. Another, and I think the one that we'll see the most of in this country, certainly already have, is what I would call sort of neoliberal climate politics, neoliberal state solutions. And here I think the answer is, rather than considering that we have too much influence of markets, too many things have been commodified, the answer is no, we need to commodify more things. We need to create new markets, markets for the atmosphere, markets for water, make derivatives out of these things so we can sell them, make them fungible, right? So we can do, for example, habitat conservation plans that swap out one part of nature with species on it for a different one, so some investor or nation state can develop a place that they want to destroy. The carbon markets, the RED program for forests, these are all what I would call climate derivatives, right? And really the key move here is to double down on the logic of commodification and the logic of enclosure, right? The logic of the market, it's going to solve everything. And I think that this is, we can see this, I think, probably will be expressed in among some forces at the march tomorrow. And I think this is the real battle that's going to be taking place. And you can see manifestations of this in all sorts of places. So this is, I think, in the U.S. going to be the dominant version. And then finally, and all these are all interrelated, I think some kind of eco-nationalism, some kind of basically looking at this crisis as something which, of course, will affect the South, the global South, more. There will be many, presumably, refugees, it's thought. There's going to be disease outbreaks like Ebola, like other forms of new outbreaks, new health problems, and the response we can expect from many nation states in the global north, unfortunately, is to double down on the already existing kind of apartheid, kind of fortress Europe, fortress America that we already see. It may not explicitly say this is because of climate, although in the case of, say, Bangladesh and India, where India is apparently building a fence, you know, in the event of future climate refugees from Bangladesh, you could see it may be a fairly explicit form of politics. But whatever the case, it's going to be, I think, a continuation, a doubling down of the most pernicious, the worst aspects of the existing system. So in other words, a climate catastrophe and a politics that simply appeals to this catastrophe as a fact, and in particular mobilizes fear, right? The justifiable fear. It's a terrifying situation that the world is in. But if there are certainly forces in the world, which actually those movies that everyone mentioned, in the very mainstream Hollywood kind of way, basically say, yeah, there's people that would rather build an ark and get themselves off of the planet than to help everybody else. That was the plot of this terrible movie, which one? 2012, right? Or Elysium, same thing, same scenario, right? So it's not exactly a very exotic, you know, idea to think that there are various forces in the world that even if they, you know, we know, I think, that they're not going to, nobody escapes this crisis, really. I mean, no, certainly, I mean, humans won't go extinct, but it's going to be a very diminished life for almost everybody. But what really matters is that there's people in the world in positions of power who think they can escape, who think that they have, you know, that it's not, doesn't apply to them. And I think certainly we can see the appeal of various kinds of eco-nationalism. And particularly this will be under the sign of Malthus, that is the specter of overpopulation. We already have this discourse, this language, which tells us that the hordes of poor people in the global south need to practice more self-control, reproduce less, are consuming too many resources. So we already have a kind of a common sense, right? And all of these three, so the scientific techno-engineering fixes, the neoliberal fixes, and the kind of eco-nationalist fixes, should they emerge, play into our common sense. So to challenge them, we have to think differently. And as I think this is happening, at these mobilizations. Finally, in terms of environmentalism as it exists, I think, you know, the climate justice movement has made huge inroads. There's a certain kind of parallelism between the focus on lifestyle and austerity, that people should consume less, right? In the global north, environmentalists are often associated with, you know, let's be more austere, let's use different kinds of light bulbs and other consumer goods, let's drive less and so forth. This is a kind of strategy. It always strikes me that it's very much a parallel with, of course, the austerity that's being demanded since the 2008 banking crisis, right? There's austerity that we're all in this together. We have to tighten our belts because, you know, the whole system is in crisis. And while I'm sympathetic to the austerity initiatives on the personal level from the environmental movement, I think that we have to be attentive to that sort of language as too. I think movements have to promise not just austerity, consuming less, a kind of a harsher life, but in fact a better life. And I think that's what social movements in fact do present to us when we participate in them. It enriches our lives in a way that we can't attain from alienated consumption. So I think that is maybe the best appeal for the new kinds of climate movements that will be necessary. Thank you.
I'm not going to be 15 minutes. Okay. Approaching the climate crisis seriously requires thinking about two things that make the contemporary left very uncomfortable: scale, meaning large scale, and state coercion, both carrots and sticks. Arun asked me to give some sense of the size of the carbon sector in the economy, and I'll be happy to do that. Moving beyond petroleum, to steal a line from BP, requires taking on a very big industry. Some sense of its size: oil and gas extraction accounts for about 2% of GDP. Add coal, takes it just over 2%. The processing and distribution of those carbon assets takes another 1% or so. The chemical industry, which is heavily dependent upon petroleum, also a bit over 2%. Transportation, heavily but not irreversibly carbon-dependent, another 2% or so. And the transportation sector, also around 2%. Add this all up and you get to about 8% of GDP. That's large, but it's still less than half the size of the financial sector. Transportation and the manufacture of transportation equipment, though, are quite malleable. It's quite possible that GM and Ford could make low-carbon vehicles, as well as high-carbon vehicles, although they're not about to do it voluntarily. But if you just look at the direct carbon interests as a share of the U.S. economy, it's just over 3% of GDP. So it's big, but not dominant or almighty or unimaginably huge, too huge to take on. Some sense of its political power: the energy sector is a major campaign contributor, about, I think, 10th in open secret listing of interest group contributions over the last couple of years to politicians and to parties. But 70 million, of that 70 million, about 80% went to Republicans. Dirty industry and low-wage employers are the corporate base of the Republican Party. But still, despite the size of those contributions, they're well below the biggest sector, once again, finance, which is everywhere you look, which gives, more than four times as much as the energy sector, almost $300 million. That's more evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, by the way. But the energy sector is behind lawyers and lobbyists, which is a favorite of the Democratic Party, the healthcare sector, the communications, electronics, high-tech sector, and organized labor. Organized labor is actually a bigger campaign contributor than the energy sector. If we could include transportation, maybe that's 40 million, which is also heavily Republican. Again, very much like the share of GDP figures, though, the campaign contributions of the energy sector are large, but not in any sense dominant. So entrenched carbon interests are big in both economic and political terms, and of course, a lot of other things depend upon them. You know, this microphone I'm talking on. And that's one of the reasons that the divestment business is so silly, since everything else runs on carbon. It's kind of weird to single out the carbon sector for your divestment. But speaking of the silliness of that divestment thing, I'm really not quite clear on what that 350 movement is trying to accomplish. No doubt there are people around who think that by selling ExxonMobil stock, you're somehow depriving that company of funds. But in fact, you're just selling the shares to someone else. Someone who thinks those shares are going to rise in value, probably. And that has no economic impact that I can tell on the company. The divestment campaign is totally embedded in a neoliberal worldview of individualized decisions operating through markets, reducing what should be a political question to one of asset allocation. Nor will individual consumptions do it either. Yes, recycling, composting, toilets, solar panels on your rooftop, all these things are helpful. I'm not going to disparage that. But it's not enough, and it's going to take too long. No, we need things to happen more quickly and a very large scale, which is one reason why this march, which is consciously modeled on the nuclear freeze march of 30 years ago, which also made no demands so as to maximize the crowds. That's one of the reasons this march is so frustrating, although it does give us lots of opportunity to do subversive things around the edges. So what do we need? We clearly need to phase out the use of carbon-based energy as quickly as possible. And the only entity that can make that happen is the state, pressured by organized popular forces. And I should acknowledge my deep debts to Christian Parenti in developing my thoughts on this. This means taking on a large but by no means dominant economic sector or a set of related sectors and essentially devaluing them. Basically means putting ExxonMobil out of business, at least in its current form. I suppose ExxonMobil could be born again as a solar and wind energy company. That wouldn't be as satisfying as socializing the thing. But the oil and coal sectors have to go. And to do that, we need both carrots and sticks on a scale that only states can provide. This is a struggle on many fronts. I mean, there's a possibility of a carbon tax to raise the price of fossil fuels to change behavior. That's a marketplace solution, but we need more than that as well. What's derided by free market types and third-way environmentalists is command and control approaches are absolutely necessary. Progressively stiffer emission standards, government-sponsored research and development, almost all the major technological innovations of the last 50 or 70 years were financed at the outset by government, not private industry, and we need lots more of that. But there's also plenty we can do with already existing technology. We could create solar-powered energy just by using lenses and boiling water if we wanted to create steam. We could have high-speed rail. The Chinese have built, 10,000 miles of high-speed rail over the last several years while we're still struggling to speed things up in the Northeast Corridor here. We need to not merely encourage but force the adoption of solar, wind, and other renewable technologies. You know, here in New York, the East River actually could be a substantial source of energy because of their currents underneath. There's Germany has been getting lots of attention recently. There was an article in the New York Times recently, and Naomi Klein has been talking about it. But the German state was really at the heart of what's been done, forcing the adoption of wind and solar, forcing utilities to accept surplus generation capacities sold back into the grid, which is not something that's happened here. This all requires intervention, planning, investment on a very large scale. Also, government procurement practices need to be changed. We need the federal government is the largest consumer of energy in the world. If it were to buy cleaner vehicles, retrofit its buildings, this would provide a vast and ready market for innovative technologies that then could be create great economies of scale and encourage adoption by everyone else. And the Clean Air Act. We have existing legislation, as Christian loves to point out, that could be used to regulate the emission of greenhouse gases now. In other words, we don't need new legislation. We just need to enforce the laws that we have now, and that's just not really happening. None of this is going to happen with spontaneous self-organization or clean energy cooperatives or individual investment or consumption decisions. It's only going to happen if we have organized popular forces making demands on the state to force these things to happen, to assure markets for clean energy. And we do that, private capital will follow. It will not lead, however. Now, devaluing a big sector, big but not almighty, I want to emphasize to encourage the optimism that it can be done. It's a big task, but it also would involve creating something new, something that could be economically stimulative, a whole new array of clean energy and clean transportation sectors that could buy us some time to think about what a post-money, post-job economy might look like. And maybe Fran can explain to us how this social movement will become possible.
Arun asked me to speak about the history of social movements in the United States. What he expects me to argue, and I will, is that even though we don't learn about American history as a history critically influenced by social movements, that in fact it was from the very beginning, from the American Revolution through the abolitionists and the Civil War and the new birth of freedom which followed the Civil War to the populist movement at the end of the 19th century to the great labor movement which finally erupted in the 1930s to the civil rights movement, to the women's movement, to the GI movement, which ultimately halted the war in Vietnam. Now, we don't read the history this way, and the movements are not always there, but when they emerge and when out of anger and hope they gather momentum, they have a critical kind of power that has changed American institutions, and that power is the power of refusal, the power that comes from the refusal of cooperation in institutional routines. In other words, it comes from the strike power, writ large, to take account of the capacity for refusal and disruption that is available to all kinds of people in all kinds of situations. These movements, when they erupt, however, they need a kind of protection because otherwise they can be crushed by the threat of force, by the army moving in, by the police moving in. You know that because you always say, in meetings like this, somebody always says, well, how can we have a movement when the risks of repression are so very great? Well, how do movements come to use this kind of power? It's a latent power most of the time. Sometimes it wells up and people find the courage to refuse. And by refusing, throw sand in the gears of American institutional life and force responses from the authorities. Well, there are several conditions, I think, which make movements possible, even in the face of the threat of coercion, because coercion is weaker. And one condition has to do with a weak and divided state. This was clearly the case during the American Revolution, which was not the creation of George Washington and James Madison and all those famous founding fathers by themselves. They were actually interested in a war with England to throw off the shackles on American commerce that was created by the English Parliament, that were created by the English Parliament. But there was another great force in the American Revolution, and it was the force really created by angry farmers and craftsmen and laborers in the cities. And what they responded to, what they saw in the possibility of a war with England, getting rid of the crown, what they saw was the hope of democracy. And they were able to fight for that hope and to make some headway. They were able to fight for that hope because once the English crown was gone, once the redcoats were gone, the American state builders were really very weak because there was no developed state. Something similar is true and accounts for the success of the abolitionists. The movement emerged in the 1830s. It infuriated the South and finally scored, or at least was able to precipitate a civil war, a horrible civil war to be sure, that led to the elimination of legal chattel slavery. They were able to do this because the South left. The South seceded from the Union. All of the great accomplishments, the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments to the Constitution that eliminated chattel slavery were made possible because of this great division in the American state. The civil rights movement also. The civil rights movement drove the South out of the Democratic Party. They were infuriated at civil rights demands and at the concessions that were being made by JFK, LBJ, and a Democratic Congress. It was when the South was leaving the Democratic Party that the Democratic Party could become the champion, for a time at least, of civil rights in the United States. The other way, and I should note it, that movements acquire some protection from state coercion. The other way is because there is an overlap between electoral constituencies, between voter blocs and movement participants, so that politicians are afraid to call out the army because they will lose votes if they do that. Well, movements also raise new issues, and that's what the climate movement so far is doing, and doing very, I think, successfully. It is a real movement. It is already a movement. We're not talking about beginning a movement. We're talking about building a movement. And movements are able to do that because they raise the issues that party politicians in a two-party system want to suppress. They don't want to raise divisive issues because a two-party politician, they have to have 51% in a sense of the vote in order to win. And that's very difficult in a divided and fractious country. So they suppress issues. Movements thrive because they raise the issues that are otherwise suppressed. And there's a glorious movement repertoire for doing this kind of insurgent communication. That's why we have the marches, the parades. After all, a march doesn't cause institutional breakdown, which is ultimately where our power comes from. No, a march just, it is communicate. That's what we want to do. That's why we're singing. That's why we have banners. That's why we have chants. That's why we have slogans, costumes, all the things that make movements so enjoyable. But the refusal, that sort of hidden, unacknowledged source of power in a movement, the refusal and the breakdown that refusal causes. Students don't go to school. Workers don't go to work. People don't clear the streets. That kind of refusal also is communicative. When, you know, there were movements that swept Latin America in the last 20 years, those movements, their distinctive tactic was blocking highways. Blocking highways, nothing works. The food trucks don't come in. Nothing happens. And you know those Latin American movements in Bolivia and Chile and Argentina and Brazil, in Uruguay and Peru, Ecuador, those Latin American movements toppled governments, changed societies. You know, I don't know if we're going to be able, through this movement, to bring down the carbon industry or to force it to turn green. Can you imagine Dick Cheney turning green? I don't know whether Naomi is right and the climate change movement is going to ultimately become a lever for transforming capitalism. You don't know either. We don't know. But we have a kind of list. Doug gave us one version of the list. It's a fine version. A kind of list of reforms that we must win that are doable. And that's what the movement has to do as a first step to longer term transformation. We don't know about the subsequent steps because we can't know about complicated and uncertain situations that far in advance. But we don't have any choice. You know that. That's why you're here. We don't have any choice but to try to put a halt to the devastation of the planet.
Since Doug was so parsimonious with his time, I'm actually going to ask him to address one more thing that I think is very important to the issue of catastrophism, neo-Malthusian concepts like degrowth, carrying capacity, and there are other ones, peak oil.
Well, peak oil, I could just say, wouldn't it be nice if it were so? But so far it's not. And I always love to quote this line, but I wrote the introduction of this catastrophism collection, and in it I quote a bit from a poem by A.R. Ammons, who said that, who wouldn't turn up the voltage when you know the lights are going out? So if you tell people you're running out of something, it might not necessarily encourage the responsible consumption of it, but might say, what the hell, let's go for it now. So I don't think that, as with the invocation of catastrophe, the sense of peakism, might have perverse effects of either disengagement or encouraging really reckless behavior. So, and then, you know, of course, we are extending the production of oil through the horrendous technology of fracking, and the United States is, you know, now becoming what, the world's second largest oil producer. It's just we're exporting oil for the first time in decades. It's really, it's all very, very grotesque. So, I mean, just talking about peak oil is very unfortunate. Both, I think it's inaccurate, but also has unfortunate psycho-political effects as well. Degrowth, you know, I always wonder precisely what that means. We have a population around the world of about 7 billion people. Reducing the population, I don't think too many people are going to volunteer for that task. So I'm not sure how we go about doing that. And the worst ecological offenders in the world have very slow-growing populations. So, I mean, it's the U.S. is certainly the most rapidly growing of the rich countries, but, you know, we're growing less than 1% a year in population terms. But, you know, we just produce too much waste of all kinds. And I think an emphasis on quality rather than quantity is a good idea. But capitalism as we know it cannot live with no growth. So if we want to talk about degrowth, it's you need some kind of planned economy to do that sort of thing, which I'm all for, but it's a tall task. But yeah, I think with the climate crisis, it presents us with a real dilemma in that the thing is so urgent that something must be done quickly, and we can't have the luxury of waiting for a total social revolution for that to happen. So I think we need to think about how we can make take some really significant reformist steps that will actually make a difference and give us some breathing room to think about longer term transformations. So I don't quite understand how we can have degrowth or any of those sorts of things in the near future, and what we really need are the urgent adaptation of or adoption of existing technologies that will give us time before the oceans are up around our ankles.
Can I just say something, Arun? Doug, isn't growth, and the sense that there is growth, everybody think, isn't that an artifact of what we choose to measure and how we measure it? Why don't we measure other things that are produced by a more slow-growing or even a stable society? Why can't we measure caring activities? Why can't we, let's put them into the equation, why can't we measure entertainment? And say we're growing.